Outkick the coverage with Clay Travis live every weekday morning from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, 3 to 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for Outkick the coverage at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every morning on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
Now let's get this party started.
You're listening to Fox Sports Radio.
Thought that I would hit a little bit at least the NFL playoff picture here in the division that will never die, the NFC East. Right now, the team that would get to host a home playoff game are the Giants, who are sitting at 4-7. And if you break down that 4-7 Giants team, they would get to play against a LA Rams team that would travel all the way across the country right now if the season were ending. And that would be your 4-5 matchup. The Seahawks would be the beneficiaries of their win last night. They would be in first place in the NFC West, the toughest division in all of sports. And the Eagles would fall all the way down to just above the Dallas Cowboys at 3-7-1. And the whole thing is just, the NFC East is just a total and complete mess. And it's ironic that I made the bad decision to bet on the NFC East team going up against an NFC West team. I don't know what in the world that I was thinking about there. We just finished, by the way, talking with my buddy. If you're just starting off the day, I encourage you to go download the podcast. Make sure you catch up with my buddy Chad Withrow at Withrow Zone, hanging out and talking about the ridiculousness of all the coverage surrounding the kicker for Vanderbilt, the female kicker, Sarah Fuller. And a big part of me, as we were going to break, I was kind of laughing about the idea. There's been a lot of talk about the University of Tennessee and Jeremy Pruitt, and they still play against Vanderbilt next week in what would be the final game of the season for Vanderbilt at 0-9. And I'm wondering if we could have a Rudy-like ending for the Vanderbilt Commodore season. Can you imagine if she came in on the field to kick a field goal to beat Tennessee to win the only game of the year, could even be an extra point, to win the only game of the year for Vanderbilt? Would that create a Rudy-like movie? Like, is there any doubt that if she came on the field to beat Tennessee, the rival of Vanderbilt, for their only win on the season, this would be like when Rudy got the sack against Georgia Tech. And oh, by the way, I think he was offsides. But Dub, can you imagine that? Would they have to just quit and hang up the Tennessee football program at that time? Would Tennessee have to refuse to allow their logo to be used in the movie because they would be such the villains in that movie that when she made that kick and the celebration started, Jeremy Pruitt probably get fired, everything else? Can you imagine if a game like that came down to a conclusion in the SEC? Would Tennessee be able to refuse to allow their logo to be used and make them try to pretend that it was some other team that happened to?
They'd have to do something. I mean, if that happened, I think it would be the most perfect ending to the 2020 football season. just end everything in the NFL, in the college football. I mean, there would be a movie, an ESPN E60 or whatever they're called at the very least. Pruitt, I mean, he wouldn't be left on the – is that game in Knoxville or in Nashville?
Nashville, but Vanderbilt's not really allowing fans, many of them anyway. I think family and they were allowing students, but the students are off the campus now, so even that's not very common. I mean, it would be an incredible ending, right? I mean, for the Jeremy Pruitt era, I mean, he would get fired. Like, I just think Jeremy Pruitt, if that happened, would have to just jog right down the tunnel out onto the street and just keep running, you know, like Forrest Gump and never return. Like, I don't, there should be a clause in his contract that if you lose to Vanderbilt on a walk-off to avoid them going 0-10 on the season, that you just have to bail, right? Like, there's no other way for things to go.
Absolutely. And, I mean, Vanderbilt, yes, they lost 41-0 against Missouri, but all the way back when the college football season started, they almost beat Texas A&M, which is one of the more head-scratching results of the entire season. 12-7, they lost to the Aggies. So, I mean, they've got it in them to keep it competitive, we've seen. So, you know, is this totally out of the realm of possibility? I say no. I think there is a slight chance that this potentially could happen.
Well, look, nobody wants to go 0-10. obviously, and that's probably a record because usually in the SEC you only play eight, right? So it's unlikely, I think, that anybody in the SEC is ever going to go 0-10 again. Because I don't know, unless they decide to change the way that they set up the college football season, and maybe they will. Maybe they'll look and say, hey, maybe it's better to play more conference games instead of less. Who knows what the end result might be. But I don't think there'll be anybody go 0-10, right? So it's such a challenging position to find yourself in the first place that I think the likelihood going forward is fairly slim that we will ever find ourselves in a situation like this again. So a walk-off field goal like that would just be remarkable, the scenario, in order to watch that happen. Just wanted to hit on that a little bit because I was thinking about it more after the conversation with Chad Withrow. The other thing, by the way, Dub, I know we talked about Seattle and the fact that they're now in the lead in the NFC West and what that can mean going forward. Can you believe, as you look kind of at the Carson Wentz scenario, and we started off the show talking about this, the guy is getting hit at such an incredible rate. And you talked about this. We were watching the game last night. How fortunate is he that there are no fans present for Eagles games? Because if there were, I think they might have to bench him just because things are so deafening that it would be impossible for the coaching staff to not. I know coaches claim they don't care about fans, and I know they're like, oh, we're watching the tape and we're looking at the film. Is there any way that Carson Wentz is still going out there and starting for the Eagles if the Eagle fans are booing as loudly and as often and as vociferously as they would be in this scenario?
I mean, there's no doubt about it. He might be the single biggest beneficiary of no fans in the stands of anybody across the entire country in sports, because I guarantee you, the Eagles had no chance winning that game late in the fourth quarter. That game was over. That stadium would have been absolutely full of Philly fans, and we all know how Philly fans like to act. They would be booing until the clock hit zero all night, and I think you're right. I think how could the coaching staff not make a change at that point? Because this wouldn't be the first game it happened at either.
By the way, and I know that they had the Hail Mary at the end of the game. Is there anybody out there who was in total disbelief that the ball wasn't picked off in the end zone for the Eagles just based on the way that entire scenario went down, that they wouldn't have ended up with that ball being intercepted? I mean, it was such a crazy ending. And depending on which side you had from a gambling perspective, this was one of the greatest covers of all time and a glorious push, or one of the worst beats of all time. Because not only did the Eagles hit the Hail Mary on an incredible catch there, they then went for two and scored with ease. The game, I think, Dub, went off at the Seahawks as a 6.5-point favorite, right? So that 2-point conversion swung a lot of money the other direction. And if you were fortunate enough to have the Eagles plus 6.5, it cashed a check for you.
Yeah, and people with those tickets can thank the analytics and Doug Peterson for that one.
Yeah, because that's the play when you end up in that scenario, as you go for two, because it gives you a chance. And by the way, would have really been remarkable if the Eagles had gotten the onside kick and then thrown a double Hail Mary. I don't think I've ever seen that happen before, to go for the win against the Seahawks. That would have truly been remarkable. All right, when we come back, we're going to be joined by who are we going to be joined by? We're going to be joined by Billy Lucci, who is at Texags, to talk about college football.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick, the coverage with Clay Travis, weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
We are joined now by Billy Lucci, who is the owner of Texags.com, a wildly popular site that covers the Texas A&M Aggies. Billy, thanks for getting up early with us, first of all. And second, a lot of years I know you've covered Texas A&M. And in recent history, A&M has been in a position where we talk about them in September and October, and then they kind of have that swoon later in the season. Three games left to play, coming down the stretch run, Auburn this weekend, then you got Ole Miss, then you got Tennessee. Why is this team different? Do you think they are? Where can they go? It's a lot of questions all rolled into one.
Yeah, and you're so right, Clay. I mean, I know your interest in A&M spiked, and when we first started to get to know each other was during the conference realignment. And then So you've been a close follower of A&M football since at least then. And right at the beginning of that, even with Johnny Manziel, don't forget that that team lost, I think they were 2-2 to open conference play. So they didn't even have this opportunity.
Yep.
So it's been a while, but I'll tell you what the difference is, Clay. And I'm writing, you know, I know everybody was down on A&M's offense this week, and it's funny because they ignore 12-7 against Louisville for Notre Dame. They hype up a 14-point win over North Carolina, and then A&M gets panned and, you know, drug over the coals for a 13-point win over LSU. This team in its last four games has gotten better and better, and they took a step back offensively. I think 3 weeks off and all the insanity of the contact tracing, which led to about 15 guys not being able to practice for 2 weeks, and I think it showed up. But if you look, here's what's different. What's different is Jimbo Fisher's teams historically have played their best football in November, and you saw A&M do that in year one under him. And I think second, Clay, they're not incredible at anything. When you watch them, you don't go, gosh, that's the best team in the country. But if you go back and look, they run the heck out of the football. They've got arguably one of the two best backs in the SEC, and Isaiah Spiller. They've got a future high-round draft pick at tight end. They've got four senior starters on the O-line, and the fifth guy's a sophomore. That'll probably be a first-round pick. They block. They've given up three sacks this year in seven games. They run the football. They've got a senior quarterback that up until Saturday was playing the best ball of his career. And then defensively, quietly, they rank second in the SEC against the run, and they lead the conference in total defense. So this is a very well-balanced, well-rounded, up until they're fifth in the country and third down conversions led the country heading into Saturday when they were miserable 2-16. So, Clay, here's the thing. They check every single box where they're, like, good at everything and really good at a lot of things, and there's very few what I would call weak spots in this football team. And the schedule that looks so daunting at the beginning of the year, they got by Alabama and Florida 1-1, and then you really look at the rest of that schedule, and LSU is down, and Tennessee's down, and Auburn's just all right, and Mississippi State was bad, and Arkansas's better, but they're still probably going to finish 3-7. So a 10-game SEC schedule that wasn't nearly as daunting as it looked when they put it together.
We're talking to Billy Lucci. He's the owner of TexAgs.com. So I'm really kind of fascinated by the fact of the couple of games getting canceled, because we've talked a lot on this show, and I know you and I have texted back and forth about this. Mm-hmm. A&M had very few positive tests. It was all almost entirely contact tracing. Now that you're through that, what can you tell me about what occurred at A&M that led to two games being postponed? And how fortunate is A&M that they're in the SEC where you can get games postponed as opposed to canceled? Because if A&M has the same issue in the Big Ten or the Pac-12, those are games that never get made up.
Yeah, and could prove very costly, because you look at this playoff chase, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a second. But, I mean, losing a couple games there would have been devastating, especially winnable games, you know. And so they had – okay, so here's what they had, Clay. They had one player test positive after Halloween. And they played Arkansas Halloween, and then that following week leading up to South Carolina, they had a starting safety not make the trip. He was positive. Okay, so he's out for the next 10 days, so two games. And coming back, they get back on Sunday, and they test on Sunday, and one player and one staffer, let's just call it a GA, I don't know his exact position, not one of the main coaches, but one staffer and one player had it. Well, the player, he's a DB, a defensive back, which he was. So you had a defensive back, and you go team meal. They're sitting in little small tables. You know, you're on the road in a hotel, probably had a roommate.
Yeah.
Who'd he sit by on the plane? Okay, sat by this guy. So one player and one staffer led to like six, just from the flight alone, 16 people contact traced.
That's insane.
16. So, like, between the positive test and the secondary, which wiped out. And here's the deal, Clay. It wasn't just more than a dozen players. It was also, I think, of the 11 full-time coaches, like, at least seven of them were out for 2 weeks contact tracing. Because one of the, because the grad assistant and the one player that I guess his position coach was around. So it, by the time, so they missed Tennessee with all those guys out. No one else got it. That number never grew. Those guys were tested that were in quarantine for 2 weeks, seven times.
Ugh.
Not one additional case. So when A&M, by the next weekend, when they played Ole Miss, they didn't have a single player in the program that had COVID and they couldn't play a football game.
Just because. So what do you know what the quarantine process is like for the A&M guys? So those guys who never test positive, what do they actually have to do? Do they just have to go sit in the, in their dorm room by themselves? Do they put them in a hotel room? What do they do for that quarantine process?
Well, they typically have, most of the kids live off campus in either houses or apartments. So they just kind of, I don't know exactly what they, I know that they can, they attend Zoom meetings and stuff,
right.
And stuff like that, but they can't be in the facilities. And I think they actually can work out, like they can kind of go up there and run and stuff. The ones that don't have it, ones that are in quarantine.
Because sometimes those guys are in a worse spot, right? Because if you test positive, you can test out by not testing positive anymore. But if you're contact traced, some of those guys can get multiple times contact traced, unfortunately, during the course of a season, right?
Yeah, and it's interesting. And I think they do a good job with the guys that have it. They're good. They're not even in the testing protocol. So if you think about that, like, and that's what teams don't release that information. And I'm sure you're sitting there all across the country, fans of their teams going, man, I wonder if this star player and this star player have had it. Because
right.
If they have, then I don't.
Then
have
you don't
to
have to worry
about
it.
Them ever missing.
Yeah, you don't end up with a Denver Broncos like situation where suddenly everybody has to not be able to play quarterback, right?
Yeah, and I think they should provide that info. It's not for gambling purposes, but just for the fans' peace of mind. You know, if you look at if you're Florida with Kyle Trask, you're going to the SEC title game, wouldn't you feel better knowing that he had already had it? So nothing can go wrong there. So there is that. That's an interesting part of it. But
especially with the playoff race coming up. Because, right, like at least if you're Clemson, you're like, well, we know that we don't have to worry anymore about Trevor Lawrence, right? He's going to be there for all the big games that Clemson has the rest of the season.
No doubt about it. I mean, Trevor Lawrence is in the clear. And so it's wild to think that A&M had that few cases and couldn't play. And not only that, but like I said, couldn't practice for 2 weeks. And it, you can see where it could mess up the entire season for a team. And the Aggies played LSU. They're probably fortunate they weren't playing a better team because they went out there and they did not look like the same team. But here's the thing. Here's my big complaint of the weekend as far as the A&M narrative went and watching that game, rewatching it on TV. It was a pretty driving rainstorm. They hadn't played in 2 weeks. Kellen Mond tweeted the Monday all the quarantine guys got back and said, I'm back. So one can only assume that he was one of the quarantines. Didn't practice for 2 weeks. And so your quarterback practiced for 3 days leading up to LSU. He looked like a shell of himself. And A&M still led 20-0 before the end of the third quarter. Their last four games by the end of the third quarter, they led LSU 20-0, Arkansas 42-17, South Carolina 34-0, and Mississippi State 28-7. You go back five games and they beat Florida. This team's been playing really good, and they've been throttling SEC opponents. And no one talked about it. And then all of a sudden, in the 1 week where they looked sloppy, and it was not. If I wasn't a fan of either team, I wouldn't have like enjoyed watching that game unless you like seeing great defense, which A&M had. But everybody was just kind of piling on it, and I'm going, wait a second. It's 20-0 through three. LSU's never been within two scores since towards the end of the first quarter. it's not, I didn't understand the hubbub, but it really doesn't matter for the Aggies, because if you look at that playoff picture, if they win out, they're going to be sitting right there, whether they win these next three games 100-0 or whether they win them each by a point. They're going to be sitting at number five, and they're going to need just a little bit of help. Not much, though.
So, yeah, that's one of the big questions that I have that I think is really kind of fascinating about this entire process. We always have debates about how good someone is and assessing, let's say, the Big Ten versus the SEC or the ACC against the Big 12 or whatever else. How in the world do you assess a team that played six, which may be the case with Ohio State, with a team that might play 12, like might be the case with Notre Dame, or a team that might play 10, like A&M, or 11, like Bama and Florida, and determine how to assess that overall?
I don't think you can assess it. Like, I feel sorry for the committee on trying to figure that one out, because, and that's the wild card that really kind of came out of nowhere this past weekend, was the Big Ten wild card, not just because of wait, hey, what if Ohio State plays five games or six? But then you've also got the wild card of Northwestern losing. Now I don't think they'd have any chance against Ohio State. But yeah, if they were to somehow knock off Ohio State, if you're A&M, you're sitting there going, there's a possibility on two different levels now of the Big Ten not getting anybody in. And that would push A&M almost like by default up in there. And then the second part of what you're talking about, yeah, and it's so – how do you compare? Because normally, like you said, you could just sit there and go, okay, this conference did nothing. Of course, if it's the Big 12, they do nothing every preseason, every non-conference schedule, they do nothing. And then by the end of the year, people forget and just keep moving them up as they're beating each other, which is exactly what they're trying to do again with Oklahoma, which is just mind-blowing right now. I don't get it. That, because they did play non-conference games, and there was the carnage of the Sun Belt. There was Texas Tech being last second to beat Houston Baptist University. I mean, it is really truly a dumpster fire over there, not just in the conference, but specifically in Austin right now. But I don't think you can really decipher other than to, and I talked with someone on the committee before the season started, and he was telling me it really is going to come down to, you hope you have a lot of really strong football minds and people that really understand the game, that when you're watching the games played, you can tell the difference between good football and not good football. Because like never before, you're going to have to lean on that when you're trying to evaluate the strength of conferences and things like that. So I think that's a lot of what's going on. I think the most fascinating thing that could end up happening, and I think it's a legit possibility, you know, if Notre Dame beats Clemson again and A&M wins out, I think the Aggies will be in, as long as Bama beats Florida. But what the really fascinating one, and it starts to factor in everything you just asked about, what if Clemson beats Notre Dame by, I don't know, like say 14 points, where you watch that whole game and you're going, Notre Dame would never have beaten these guys. And they could never have beaten them without Trevor, you know, had Trevor not been out. If that's the case, but it's not a blowout, it's not 21 point buzz. It's 10 to 14, but Clemson total game control. And then you've got a 9-1 A&M team whose only loss was to Bama, who beat Florida, and who is on an 8-game winning streak heading in. That's going to be the most fascinating debate and decision that comes down, is if things shake out like that. And I don't think that's too outlandish a possibility. I actually think that's kind of, if you made me predict how things are going to go, I'd slightly lean towards thinking the Aggies win their last three, and I'd slightly lean towards thinking Clemson by, you know, more than a touchdown, but not in a blowout.
We're talking to Billy Lucci. He's the owner of TexAggs. You mentioned the Big 12. There's lots of smoke out there that Tom Herman is in danger of losing his job in Austin. He's asked about it virtually every week in his press conference. Tough loss for them against Iowa State. What are you hearing about that situation for Tom Herman, and who do you think Texas would like? A lot of interest, it seems, in Urban Meyer. The same kind of reports about Urban Meyer that there were about Nick Saban back in the day. $10 million offer. Shelly Meyer's looking around at houses. Everybody's wife always goes to look at houses. What do you think Texas does, and who are you hearing they might be interested in?
I think Texas moves on Tom Herman. And I've had a discussion with people who I respect that don't think that. I just do. Here's the thing, Clay. This is like, you know, whether it's Michigan, Ohio State, whether it's Alabama, you know, whether it's Auburn with Alabama, but it's A&M and Texas and Oklahoma. When Oklahoma's winning and Texas can't beat them, and when you're losing recruits, legacy recruits, who's the Brockermeyer twins, whose father was an All-American tackle, probably the best O-lineman in school history, and they're going to Alabama. You know, Texas kids, they live up in Fort Worth, and they're going to Alabama. And A&M is really getting who they want in Texas in all the head-to-heads with the Longhorns right now. And that's, you know, that's getting more, that stranglehold's getting more by the day with each passing week that A&M wins a game. It is like, it's a real problem for Texas, because if you bring Tom Herman back right now, I just don't see how, if you're an administrator, a decision maker, a big donor, I don't see how you can have any confidence or faith. You know, there's got to be just this giant vote of no confidence if you had asked, can this man and his staff recruit at the level they need to? And as you know, Clay, it's not just this 21 class, which is like they're dead in the water on this one, but it's also the 22 class, which also happens to be the most loaded class I've seen in 25 years of covering this state. So, I mean, if you can fall so far behind that I don't care if they hire Urban Meyer with Nick Saban as his defensive coordinator. It's going to be hard to dig out of that kind of hole. And I think that's what they're scared of more than anything. And you know how success on the other side drives those decisions. A lot of times they're panic driven, right? And,
yeah,
and
yeah.
If A&M wins the next couple weeks and it looks like they have a real look at the playoff, and Oklahoma's righted the ship after those two losses, and you're going to sit there and go tell all your donors and your big money people, hey, we're going to ride this out for another year because, you know, the pandemic and the climate, and, you know, I just don't – big business, man, and I just don't think it's going to fly. I know if you're an A&M fan, trust me, I know, because I read it every single day. I know you're hoping that they don't change coaches, and Aggies were in a very weird spot on Saturday, because I know a lot of buddies of mine that were watching it that were rooting for Texas to win that game, and they felt really weird doing that because you weren't just rooting for them to win. Kansas State's terrible. Kansas is terrible. You were pulling for them to make it, to advance to the Big 12 title game.
Yeah.
And maybe even have a chance to win it with a mild upset over OU, who they went to four overtimes with. And A&M fans didn't even care. Like, oh, fine, let them win the Big 12. That's how. Just kind of neutered Herman and that program are over there right now.
So,
and I don't
if it's,
say that.
If it's not, yeah, no, I get it. I think it's kind of fascinating. If it's not Urban Meyer, who do you think they would look to?
I don't know. I mean, I've seen a list of about 10 different names, and they get carried away. I've always thought, and it doesn't seem like right now, if I'm looking, James Franklin, I've always thought would be a good fit for that program.
I think he would have been a great hire, but now they're 1-5, and I don't know how you justify firing Tom Herman in a COVID year for not having a good enough year and go hire, a Penn State coach who went 1-5.
Exactly. I thought they should have hired him when they did hire
Tom Herman,
or Charlie Strong. I forget which one it was, but when he was just
I think it was Charlie Strong the first time that he was before he went to Penn State.
Yeah, I thought he was going to rip him from your Commodores, actually.
Yeah, that's right.
But Texas, a lot of times will think they're too good to do that. And so Man, I've always thought Gary Patterson would be a great fit there, but now he's a little long in the tooth. Again, another one you'd wonder if they could have hired either of the last two times. I've always thought he would leave for A&M or Texas. I don't know what's out there. You know, Chris Harsin has ties to the program. He's done a nice job at Boise. What's Clemson's offensive coordinator's name? I've seen his name come up.
Yep.
I don't think Texas goes that route. I mean, one of the early names they were throwing around was Kyle Shanahan. The last time they threw around John Harbaugh, like they do this, and I go back to what you just said, and I think that's got to be their big concern is if you make a change on Tom Herman, who's not terrible. He's not terrible, you know. But if you make a change there and you don't get an Urban Meyer, I mean, then I think you've got a real – they're not going to go hire you Freeze over there. So if you don't get Urban, would you be better off to wait another year and see how Herman does? But see, to me, without Sam Ehlinger, without Joseph Osai, they've already had a couple of opt-outs with guys that are going to get drafted. I just don't see how next year gets any better for them. And it's pretty remarkable, Clay. If you want to compare Kevin Sumlin and Tom Herman, Sumlin was an assistant at A&M under a legend in R.C. Slocum. Herman was an assistant at Texas under a legend in Mack Brown. Sumlin went to OU, won a national title as an offensive assistant under Bob Stoops. Herman, Ohio State, assistant under Urban Meyer, national championship. They both went to U of H. One went back to A&M. One went back to Texas. Strong starts there. You know, Herman in year, I guess, two wins that Sugar Bowl. Sumlin, obviously, we know what happened in year one. And then it just didn't quite work out. And, you know, for the thing to go full circle, I guess it would have to be, you know, they ended up getting Urban, like A&M went and got a national title winner. Winning coach and Jimbo Fisher, and both of them would have been relatively low-hanging fruit in the grand scheme of things with Urban not coaching and Jimbo, in hindsight, now everybody knows, was clearly not getting what he wanted at Florida State and would have left as soon as something, you know, as prestigious as A&M came around, you know, with as good a job opportunity as the Aggies presented.
Billy, appreciate the time, my man. We'll talk to you again down the stretch if the playoff race really gets underway, like I think it could. Appreciate it, my man.
All right, Clay. Keep it up, brother.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
Appreciate all of you hanging out with us as we roll through the Tuesday edition of the program. Seahawks get a wild win. You may well have gotten a wild cover if you had the Eagles. Speaking of wild, I want to let you know as we come down the stretch run here, Fox Sports Radio has been around now for 20 years. And as a result, they're naming the top 20 athletes of the past 20 years from the year 2000 all the way through 2020. Last week, they gave out the number 16 through 20. The 20th best athlete of the last 20 years, Sidney Crosby, Barry Bonds, took the 19th spot. Race car driver Jimmy Johnson was 18th. 17th was Mariano Rivera. Steph Curry was 16th. Numbers 11 through 15 of the top athletes of the century will be revealed tonight on The Odd Couple at 9:30 p.m. Eastern, 6:30 p.m. Pacific. That's tonight, 9:30 Eastern, 6:30 Pacific on The Odd Couple right here on Fox Sports Radio. Find out the next five on the list then. 20 years of athletes and 20 years of Fox Sports Radio. And I said we were going to talk a little bit about the NFL playoff picture, and it continues to kind of refine itself a little bit as we're still waiting, obviously, to see what's going to happen in a game that could be significant with the Steelers going up against the Ravens, which is why we're not able to do our top five, bottom five, which we usually do on Tuesday. It looks like we'll have to wait till Thursday till after that Wednesday afternoon kick when we come back on the show Thursday morning to break down everything. But in the wake of that win for the Seahawks, they now are the number two overall seed in the NFC. And so if you're wondering what the playoff picture would look like in the NFC, they have finished The everybody's got 11 games in at least, and a few teams have 12 games that they've completed because the Bucks, for instance, have their bye week this week. But the Saints at 9-2 are in really pretty good shape to win the NFC South, certainly, and potentially to be the overall number one seed in the NFC. The Seahawks are in the second spot, followed by the Packers in the third. Ridiculously enough, we've got the Giants in the four spot, and then we've got the Rams, the Bucks, and the Cardinals as the three remaining playoff teams, with the Vikings, the Bears, and the 49ers on the outside looking in at 5-6, trying to hopefully fight their way into the playoff. But if we were playing right now, we would be breaking everything down. This is what the playoffs would look like. In the sixth seed, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers would have to go on the road against the Seahawks. And then in the three, you would have the You would have the Arizona Cardinals going on the road against the Seahawks. So we would get a the rubber match there, right? It would be the third matchup between those two teams. And then you would have the Green Bay Packers hosting the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. That would be a pretty intriguing game. And then I don't think this is a bad draw at all. The Rams would go on the road against the Giants. They would get the best and easiest matchup of anybody in the wild card rounds at all. And so as you're breaking down where the playoff picture would go, remember that the NFC East is so bad that in addition to the fact that everybody is going to want to get the number one overall seed, that you actually have a lot of teams that in the wild card would be angling for that number five seed, because it's actually a lot easier as you break it down in general there. And so you've got right now in the AFC, the Steelers as the one seed, Kansas City Chiefs as the two, Titans as the three, the Bills as the four, Browns as your five seed, and the Titans and the Browns, who would have ever believed the best game in the NFL for next week might actually be the Titans hosting the Cleveland Browns. Then you got Miami as the six, and in the seven seed, you've got the Indianapolis Colts, and we'll have to wait and see what happens with Baltimore, because obviously if they were able to pull off a huge upset over the Steelers, they have the tie break over the Indianapolis Colts, and they would knock the Indianapolis Colts out of the playoffs with 5 weeks to go. The Colts would be on the outside looking in. So many different intriguing storylines to follow in the NFL playoffs, and maybe the most intriguing of all is how many teams are actually going to end up making the playoffs, because we still could have no bye weeks if we end up having to cancel some games. I'm going to be honest with you. I'm starting to feel like it's very likely that before all is said and done, the NFL is going to have to cancel some games just based on how crazy things have been with trying to get the Steelers and the Ravens game scheduled. We'll talk a little bit more about that as we come back to start off the third hour of the program. What do we learn from Seahawks going up against the Eagles and more? What in the world's going to happen with Carson Wentz going forward? All that and more. This is OutKick on Fox Sports Radio.